Utterly Moderate is the official podcast of the Connors Forum. Visit us at connorsforum.org and be sure to subscribe to our free email newsletter while you are there.
Please listen carefully.
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 Hey, hey, everybody. Welcome back to another episode of the Utterly Moderate Podcast. I'm your host, Lawrence Eppard. Happy summer to all of you. Thank you for joining us for another discussion. On today's episode, we are going to discuss a topic that's been back in the news recently because of the debt ceiling negotiations. And that topic is the Social Security program. Now, it's been back in the news because during these negotiations, a number of politicians and elected representatives have floated the possibility of making major changes to the Social Security program. Now, my PhD and my research background is actually in economic and racial inequalities. So I spent a lot of time with the Social Security data. And I gotta say, from my vantage point, the kinds of changes that I've heard talked about would be substantial and I think would be largely negative for our seniors. And, you know, we're all going to age. We're all going to eventually be considered elderly Americans, right? And so, and depending upon programs like Social Security and like Medicare. And so this is going to affect all of us. And if we're going to make major changes, we need to be thinking very clearly about what the ramifications of those changes are going to be. And all of us need to be a part of this discussion. So that's why I thought it was important to tackle this topic again today. Now, before we dive into what's wrong with the program, a few notes on Social Security. Let's start with its impact. For most elderly Americans, the program provides a majority of their income. And you heard that right. For most elderly Americans, a majority of their income. So for most of us, again, we're all going to age someday and get older and become elderly Americans. It's going to be the primary source of income for most of us. So we need to be thinking very clearly about how we make changes to this program. It's also arguably America's most effective poverty-fighting program. So if you look at the data, without Social Security, more than a third of seniors would be poor. With Social Security, the poverty rate for elderly Americans is actually lower than the overall poverty rate in America. So it's pretty effective at reducing poverty, I would argue. It's our most effective poverty fighting program. Now, some critics of Social Security make the argument that rather than putting your money into Social Security, you could personally invest that money in the stock market and get a better return. And that's actually true. For some Americans, that's actually true. The problem is it's not true for most Americans. So for millions of Americans, they would not end up saving the same amount of money if they were doing it themselves as they do when they have this sort of forced retirement system of Social Security. So yes, for some Americans, they could absolutely do better with that money than putting it into Social Security. The problem is that's not the case for most Americans. Furthermore, if you look at analyses by the Urban Institute, they show that the typical married couple in America actually ends up using more in retirement in Social Security and Medicare benefits than they actually paid in over the course of their lives. So what that means is if it was just the money they put in, they'd run out, right? But it's a social insurance program, and so it continues to pay for as long as you live, even if you use more than you paid in. So given all of that, given the fact that I don't think most Americans would actually save the amount of money they're forced to save with Social Security, given the fact that we tend to use more than we put in, I am highly skeptical that private investment would be a better alternative for most Americans. It would be a better alternative for some Americans, but I do not think, given my experience with these data, I do not think it would be a better alternative for most Americans. I just don't think the data says that. Now, one of the most important things to note about Social Security, and I can't even believe this is true, but it is. If you look at the surveys, this is absolutely true. It's not actually a partisan issue. it seems like a partisan issue, because if you look at the people in Congress who are talking about Social Security, it certainly cuts along tribal lines. You know, Democrats talk about it one way, conservatives another. But if you look at the polling on this, like what do actual voters say? Social Security is popular across the political divide. So strong majorities of Americans, I don't care if they're old or young, if they have high or low incomes, or if they're Republican or Democrat, it doesn't matter. Majorities in all those groups believe that it's crucial for the U.S. to preserve full Social Security benefits for future generations. And this is key, even if it means increasing payroll taxes. I can't even believe that's true, but Republicans and Democrats, if you look at voters themselves, agree that we should maintain the current program, maintain full benefits, even if it means increasing taxes. And that's just a striking amount of bipartisanship in a time where we hardly agree on anything. Now, I like to brag to people that this podcast has very smart listeners. And so most of you likely know how Social Security is funded, but I'll just do a quick review just so we're all on the same footing here. But every 2 weeks, the Social Security program receives an infusion of money from payroll taxes from current workers, and that money pays for current beneficiaries. So if you're working right now, you're paying for current retirees. As long as people keep working, there will be funding every 2 weeks for Social Security. That's not the question. The question is not, will Social Security stop receiving money? It always will receive money every 2 weeks. The question is not whether benefits will continue, but what level those benefits will be. Will it be 100% of what's been promised? So in the past, you know, historically in the U.S., the number of workers who were in the labor force and the pool of payroll taxes they were providing was large enough to support the number of beneficiaries who were currently retired. But in the U.S. today, we've had falling fertility rates, we're having fewer kids, and so that's no longer the case. The amount of money that's provided by current workers is less than what's needed for current beneficiaries. Now, the full benefits continue. You get 100% of what you were promised because of the Social Security trust funds. Those make up the difference. But those funds will be depleted sometime in the mid-2030s, 2034, 2035. At that point, the program's not going to go broke. Again, every 2 weeks, it gets money from payroll taxes. But because of the imbalance from current workers to current beneficiaries, at that point, around 2034 or so, it'll continue to pay out, but at 76% of what the promised benefits are. So if we do nothing at all to the Social Security program, it'll continue as always, but it'll pay about 3/4 of what's been promised to beneficiaries. So that's the problem. The problem is not, will Social Security go broke? No, it will not. It will always have money. The question is not, will it continue? The question is, do you want to make changes to the program so that all of us get 100% of what we were promised, or do you want to keep it going as is and only receive 3/4 of the benefits that we were promised? That's the question. Now, a while back, we had Social Security expert Kathleen Romig from the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities on this podcast to discuss how to fix the program so it continues to do what both Republican and Democratic voters want, which is to continue to pay full benefits. Now, Romig argues that the fixes are straightforward and manageable. She says the program could be made sustainable for the foreseeable future through a combination of A, increasing payroll taxes. So right now it's about 6.2% to somewhere around 7% for both employees and employers. And additionally, with that, removing the cap on taxable earnings, which I believe right now is around $160,000. Now, again, as I said, we're all going to face these inevitable constraints of old age. We can't work as much. We have health challenges. And so we need to think about the policies that either make us happier or less happy at that point in our lives. And I firmly believe Social Security helps ensure a basic level of security for millions of Americans. And there are logical, reasonable, and manageable adjustments we can make to the program to continue to allow Americans to have that sort of basic sense of security. Now, what follows are highlights from my conversation with Social Security expert Kathleen Romig on the future of Social Security and all of the concerns that I've just laid out. Hope you enjoy the conversation.
Today, a hope of many years' standing is in large part fulfilled. The civilization of the past 100 years, with its startling industrial changes, has tended more and more to make life insecure. Young people have come to wonder what would be their lot when they came to old age. The man with a job has wondered how long the job would last. We can never insure 100% of the population against 100% of the hazards and vicissitudes of life, but we have tried to frame a law which will give some measure of protection to the average citizen and to his family against the loss of a job and against poverty-stricken old age. It seems to me that if the Senate and the House of Representatives in this long and arduous session have done nothing more than pass this security bill, Social Security Act, the session would be regarded as historic for all time.
Kathleen Romig, thank you so much for joining the show.
Thank you. I'm excited to be here.
So you work at the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities in Washington, D.C. So could you tell us a little bit about what that think tank does and sort of broadly what the think tank does, but then what your role is there and the kind of work that you do within that organization?
Sure. Well, the Center on Budget focuses mostly on policies that affect lower and middle income Americans. And we are always looking to think about that in a really data-driven way and to think about how to finance those programs responsibly over the long term. In my specific role at the center, I focus on Social Security and Supplemental Security Income, or SSI, as well as paid leave.
Now, for academics like myself, it's... you know, there are think tanks that we know are do very good work because they're sort of part of the academic conversation and they're respected by others and their work is checked and they're using methods that are very similar to those that are being used by academics. And then there are some think tanks that aren't, right? So why should we trust the work that that your center does?
Well, I think that's right. I think we really do try to follow the best research and data practices that we can. And I guess one example of that, one of the most popular reports that I do every year is something that the Social Security Administration used to publish, which was showing how many people would be in poverty if they didn't have Social Security benefits. And they stopped publishing that several years ago, and we started publishing it using exactly the same methodology they did. And it's one of our most popular pieces. It's something that people really want to know.
And I can say this honestly to you, Kathleen, as a scholar of economic inequality and poverty, this is not just for the air. I would say this to you if we weren't being taped right now. Please don't stop doing that analysis.
Thank you.
It's so useful. When you show sort of what the non-Social Security poverty rate would be and what it is with Social Security, we'll get to that in a moment. We'll talk about in at length what you do with that. But very, very useful for us researchers. So thank you.
Can you talk about the history of Social Security? Tell us a little bit, you know, why it was instituted, when it was instituted, what was the rationale behind it?
Sure. Well, the program was really born of the Great Depression. You know, there was just massive unemployment and massive hardship. And there were a couple of goals, really. It started out just as an old age program, just it was called old age insurance. And the reasons were twofold. One is because older people were really suffering. There were many people who were poor, you know, we're relying on family members often who weren't employed themselves because of the Depression, or poorhouses because those existed back then. And the other reason was to get older workers out of the labor market, that there weren't enough jobs to go around. And at that point, it was in everyone's interest if some people left the labor market and left the jobs for other people. And so that's less of a purpose now, but at that point, it really made sense.
So my next question is, how effective is Social Security? What kind of impact does it have on elderly poverty?
Sure. So yeah, like I said, we use the exact same method as the Social Security Administration did when it published this data every year. And it's very, very simple analysis, just taking elderly people's income and subtracting out their Social Security benefit and seeing how many people are in poverty without it. And about a third of the elderly would be in poverty without their Social Security benefits. And interestingly, that is very similar to the number of elderly who were in poverty before Social Security existed. Now, of course, I think people would behave differently in the absence of Social Security. They possibly save more or work longer. So it's not completely, you know, we can't say that that's exactly what would happen in the absence of Social Security. But we can say that it makes an enormous difference in the well-being of not just elderly people, but all people who receive it.
Particularly when you pair it with Medicare, right?
Absolutely. Yes. Absolutely.
So I'm sure you're aware the Urban Institute a few years back put out a report, and what they basically were showing was, look, this is a social insurance program. It's going to pay for as long as you live, even if you outlive how much you pay in. And in fact, they found for the typical American, that actually was the case. The typical American will burn through more benefits than they put into the program by the time that they die, which means, so I think that gets to the point of what you're saying, which is, yes, you could act differently in the absence of Social Security. You could save. But given how long people are living now,
yes,
it's likely this program works better than savings, right?
Yes. And also, just given what happens in people's lives, I think everyone starts out with good intentions of saving, but then a pandemic hits and you lose your job for a year, or then you get divorced, or you get sick, or all kinds of things happen to people. And they're suddenly unable to save and suddenly having to tap into those savings that they were hoping to put away for their retirements. And the thing about Social Security is it's essentially forced savings, where you keep paying every job that you have. Everybody keeps pooling their money year after year, and it is there no matter what happens. You know, Franklin Roosevelt called it the hazards and vicissitudes of life, you know, that despite whatever happens with those hazards and vicissitudes of life, you keep contributing and that keeps building up. And like you said, because it's pooled, somebody who lives longer, it doesn't have to worry about outliving their savings, or someone who gets disabled earlier doesn't have to worry about, oh, they haven't built up much of a nest egg to date. So that's kind of the beauty of it, is pooling it all together.
They do like the middle income earner, low income earner, then like the high income.
I do remember that. Yeah. And one thing that we sometimes say on that topic, one thing we sometimes say about money's worth analysis is it's great if you get more than your money's worth, or you get your money's worth out of Social Security, meaning you get the same amount that you put in or even more than you put in. But it's also an insurance program. And, you know, when I buy homeowners insurance and my house doesn't burn down, I'm not like, dang it, I wasted those premiums. I wish my house had burned down and I got a big settlement. I'm actually really happy that my house is still intact. Just like I think it's, we should be grateful when we don't need to use disability benefits because we're able to, you know, continue to earn a living in a way that people who have a life-altering disability sometimes can't, or we're happy that our spouses survived into retirement. And so we're not, you know, getting that survivor's benefit. I'd rather have my spouse, frankly, you know, so I think it's that kind of analysis is important, but there are also limits to it because Social Security is there for us in our worst times. And when we are able to escape some of those worst times, we should be happy that we don't need it.
Yeah. And I often have this conversation with my students, which is, you know, if you think about Social Security, think about it as social insurance, as you said, like if you were to run out of savings, think about your position in the labor market at 80, at 85, and your ability to then say, okay, I'm going to now go make up this income in some way.
Yeah.
That's very different than if you had faulty fire insurance at 20 and you could start over. You can't really start over at that point, right?
No, right. Exactly.
Kathleen, can you tell us a little bit how Social Security is funded? Who pays for it? And how is this done?
Well, the number one source of funding is payroll taxes. So, you know, I'm paying payroll taxes and you're paying payroll taxes in every single paycheck. And almost all of those taxes immediately turn around and go to pay for current beneficiaries. You know, my parents and all the other millions of beneficiaries who are currently getting benefits. And that's the first source of revenue. Then there are also a few other sources of revenue that are smaller, like taxation of benefits for higher earning workers. But that's the main one. And in order to sustain financing for a program like that, you need to have workers working. You need to get the balance right between the number of workers paying into the system and the number of beneficiaries getting their earned benefits out of the system. And so when that's not totally in alignment, then you have a financing problem that you need to solve. And that's basically where we are now.
One thing I think is important for people to know, I saw a survey recently, I think done by the Social Security Administration, where they asked Americans, how dependent will you be on Social Security when you retire? And many Americans were quite wrong about how dependent they were going to be. So can you give us some idea of how major of a source of income it is for what number of people?
Sure. Well, most retirees rely on Social Security for most of their income. So more than half of American retirees have Social Security as their number one source of income. And I think you're right. People don't expect that. They don't. For one thing, it's when you look at the, say, the balance of a retirement account, if you have hundreds of thousands of dollars in a retirement account, that sounds like an awful lot. And when you look at a monthly Social Security benefit check, that's measured in, you know, maybe at best like $2,000 a month, and it maybe doesn't sound like that much. But when you think about making that nest egg last for decades, well, it doesn't go as far sometimes as I think people expect it to, whereas those Social Security checks keep flowing and the value of those checks is, you know, is inflation protected, and they, you know, they're more valuable than people really understand.
Let's get to the problems.
So, yes.
If you look at the ratio of workers to beneficiaries, it's been falling for a long time, right? And that's the primary problem. So the question people want to know is Social Security broken?
And the answer is absolutely not.
They're gonna want you to expand upon it.
Yeah, exactly. As long as people are working, as long as people are paying into the system as they must, Social Security will keep paying benefits. And the question now for us as a society is how much do we want to pay in and how much do we want to get out? Right now, we're not paying in enough to sustain the benefit levels that people are getting out now. We can't do that forever. When the Social Security's reserve funds are depleted, the Social Security's actuaries expect that the current payroll taxes will be able to fund about 75% of current benefits. And 75% is pretty good, but nobody really wants 75%. They want the whole thing. And so we have to figure out, well, are we going to pay more or are we going to take a benefit cut? How are we going to solve this math problem? But it's essentially an arithmetic problem. I think people think the program is just going to disappear one day. And they, you know, they hear the trust funds and they think, oh, the trust funds are, I mean, you hear this rhetoric in the media every year when the trustees report comes out, and it'll be coming out again soon. I'm sure we'll see it again soon, where they say, oh, the trust funds are running dry or they're running out. And that's just not how it works. Every 2 weeks, they get a whole new infusion of cash from people's paychecks. And so I think that if I could make people understand one thing about Social Security is that it will always be there. We may have to kind of renegotiate the deal between the generations about how big it is and how much we pay, but it will always be there.
So around what year, I know you can't pinpoint the exact year, but around what year do we get to the point where we're at 75%?
So it's right as of the last trustees report, they were saying 2035. And, you know, we're getting this new trustees report. We were pretty worried a year ago that it was going to, that the Social Security's financial position was really going to significantly deteriorate. But things are looking a lot better now. So I think, you know, from what we're hearing now, it seems like, yeah, it might be a little, the system might be a little bit worse off financially than before the pandemic, but not substantially.
So 2035, you start have to pay less in benefits because of the trust fund running out. Now, eventually, you know, fertility rates have to hit a bottom, right? Like we're not going to go down to 1.4 or something like that. Like we're eventually going to settle somewhere, even if it's slightly below replacement, it's going to be somewhere around replacement. So is that just 75% into the future? Or are we expecting that at some point?
They actually expect it to plateau. Yes,
right,
exactly.
Right.
And you're also right that fertility rates are the biggest driver of this mismatch between the number of workers and the number of beneficiaries.
So 75% is sort of the floor of what we should expect.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so we can either deal with that or we can bring it back up to somewhere higher than 75%. So let's talk about the ways that we can get those benefits back up to 100%. So there are a variety of ones. My favorite one I think you also favor is removing the earnings cap. So tell us, what is the earnings cap? Where is it set at right now? And how would that fix the problem?
So, you know, we've been talking about payroll taxes. Payroll taxes, you pay 6.2% of your wages, and then your employer pays another 6.2 on every dollar that you earn, and up to a cap. If you earn more than that amount, you just don't pay taxes above that amount. So what happens is, say someone earns $200,000, and partway through the year, they just stop paying Social Security taxes. And then they don't earn benefits based on those earnings in excess of the cap. Now, the issue with that is the last time policymakers set that cap, about 40 years ago now, it covered 90% of all of the earnings in the American economy. And now, because of really significantly increased wage inequality, it's only covering something like 83% of wages in the economy. And so there are many more wages that are above that cap now, because we have, you know, a small number of people who are earning a lot more money than they were a generation ago. And so one way that we could change that cap is by saying, okay, we always want it to cover, say, 90% of wages in the economy like it used to. Another way is just to get rid of the cap altogether. And if you did either one of those things, really, you'd have to decide, so do on those newly taxed earnings, are we going to pay a benefit on that? If we do pay a benefit on that, how generous of a benefit will it be? Will it be just sort of a token amount, or will it be a substantial amount? And that would, of course, affect how that affects the trust fund financing as well.
Okay, so let's say you do something reasonable, 90% of income, and there's benefits on that. What else? Let's say we go that route. Now, that's your preferred route, my preferred route. Mm-hmm. What else would you have to pair with that to get to full benefits?
To get to full benefits,
increase in payroll taxes, or
a payroll tax increase, and it could be a fairly modest payroll tax increase if it were paired with other things. You know, like right now it's 6.2%. Say raising it to 7%. You know, that could get you part of the way. Unfortunately, I don't have these numbers like offhand in my head. But that could get you part of the way. Another thing that could get you part of the way is applying the payroll tax to the value of fringe benefits. When policymakers last looked at Social Security in 1983, there just weren't as many fringe benefits as there are now. Things like, you know, so-called cafeteria plans, where you're getting your, say, transit subsidy or your FSA or all these different things, and they are exempt from payroll tax. Also, the value of health insurance has just climbed dramatically since 1983, the last time they opened up these questions. And simply applying the payroll tax to the value of employer-provided health insurance would make a big difference. And, you know, some people on the right, including my former boss, Andrew Biggs, who's now at AEI, you know, I've talked to him about this, and he says he likes that idea because it could help constrain healthcare costs as well. And so, you know, there are different reasons for favoring that kind of policy. Another reason is not everybody gets their health insurance through work. And the people who get it on the private market do have to pay taxes on the wages that they earn to purchase that insurance. And so it would kind of level the playing field between people who do have generous benefits at work and those who don't.
So there are some other ways we could do this. We could reduce benefits.
Yes, right? Definitely. And I think the most commonly discussed way of doing that is by raising what's known as the full retirement age. So that, you know, for people born in 1960 or later, the full retirement age is 67. And, you know, raising that age to 68, 69, even 70.
Another thing people have proposed, and again, it's not all that popular, would be to make it another means-tested program. Right, where depending upon your income, you're really not getting a benefit, right?
Right.
Explain that to us.
So that, I mean, we already have supplemental security income, SSI, that's severely means tested for the poorest retirees. I think that one of reason for Social Security's durable popularity is that it's a benefit for everybody. It's a benefit that you earn. It's a benefit that you get no matter what your circumstances. And I think that restricting eligibility would really undermine that. And I think people would not be very unhappy about it. I mean, who votes the most? Older people. I don't think they would be very happy if suddenly they became ineligible, or suddenly their benefits weren't very valuable. I think we have like a little bit of, you know, I would call it very late means testing, because we have taxation of benefits starting after the 1983 amendments, where highest income beneficiaries do have some of their benefits taxed back. But it's only a portion of their benefits, and they're taxed at about the same way that a private pension would be taxed. And that's only for the highest income beneficiaries. So there is something like that. And that's another, you know, that's an increasingly important revenue source for Social Security. But I think that's about probably as far as we'll ever go in terms of means testing. And that's not really a means test.
Yeah. And a point you made, which is a pretty standard assumption in the social sciences and the study of poverty and economic inequality and social welfare, which is the popularity of programs hinges on the populations that they benefit and notions of deservedness, right? So the elderly, just as a block, are seen as deserving. They've worked their entire lives, they've paid in. And I'm not saying it's wrong to think that means-tested folks are deserving. I mean, I wouldn't be studying this stuff if I didn't think that was the case.
Right.
But at least in the American mind, the popularity starts to really take a hit when it's going to poorer folks or non-white folks or whatever.
Yes. Maybe. Yeah, there's no stigma attached to getting Social Security. It's something people celebrate. They're excited. They're happy. They share. It's a milestone. It's not, you know, other forms of benefits. You're right. They have stigma and even shame attached to them. And that's just not the case with Social Security, because it's something that's for everybody.
Yeah. You can't really other the elderly, because it's something we're all going to experience, which is aging, right?
Yeah. It's as close to universal as anything we have.
Despite the fact that, as my colleague Mark Rank has found over and over again, most of us will be poor in our lifetimes, so you can't really other the poor either. But we do that anyway. But
so I'm a political scientist, and I also am researching in media. So obviously, I pay a lot of attention to the political rhetoric and the messaging about different government programs, and I frequently hear politicians make horrifying claims about Social Security. And at the same time, you're telling us that the program is not broken.
It's true, because truly, the Social Security Trustees Report is about to come out. And I'm sure that we're going to see these headlines that say things like bankrupt, running dry, all this dramatic stuff. And I think, you know, I don't think that the people who write those stories or write those headlines are attempting to mislead. I think there's some misunderstanding about what it means. I think there's some drama that's sort of inherent to all forms of news. And then I think there have been some politicians who have mischaracterized it on purpose. I think, you know, in the Bush years, for example, there was this talk of calculating the Social Security's deficit across the infinite horizon. Like, what does that even mean? The infinite horizon. How could we ever possibly pay these absurdly large numbers that they came up with, the hole that Social Security faces? It's completely daunting. Whereas if you put it in terms of, okay, well, if instead of paying 6.2%, we all paid 7% of our salary, and you start to think like, oh, that's another like $5 or $10 a paycheck, I could afford that. You know, that's a very different ballgame. When you think I could get 100% of benefits if only I contributed the equivalent of like a cup of coffee every week to Social Security. Well, okay, that actually suddenly starts to seem manageable. But when you're talking about like bajillions of dollars or whatever they were coming up with in their estimates of that era, then it feels really insurmountable. And it feels like you have to break the program in half in order to fix it.
So we should believe you and the actuaries.
Yes. Definitely the actuary. No, I'm just kidding.
Kathleen, we know that you really believe Social Security is sound, but how optimistic are you really about the program, given the realities of the politics around it and the conversations we're having about it today?
I actually feel very confident that over the medium term, we're going to work this out. I think that people would go crazy if you did anything too drastic with Social Security. I think that, you know, understanding that the people who rely on Social Security the most now, the elderly, are also the best voters, and they're very protective of Social Security. And I think that it's hard for me to see anything very unpopular actually passing. Also, just because of the structure of how things work in the Senate, you need 60 votes to make any changes to Social Security. So you have to come up with something that's acceptable to both parties in order to move forward on Social Security. You know, it's hard for me to imagine anything that would really threaten benefits in a serious way, at least based on how things have realigned over the last 20 years between the parties. To get 60 votes, you really would need to do something that really wasn't going to significantly harm the program. But yeah, do I think it's going to happen like this year? No, nobody thinks it's going to happen this year. Like, it doesn't have to happen right now. And I think there's going to have to be a forcing event. There was a forcing event in 1983 where the trust funds were, you know, and the trust funds are just the reserves, you know, in addition to payroll taxes, the trust funds were beginning to be depleted. That's going to happen again, you know, in another, we'll see, 15 years or so. And I think it's probably going to take an event like that for people to really sit down and compromise. But they will. I feel totally confident they will.
You feel a lot better about our political system than I do. But what would you say when you look out across the political landscape, you look out across the popular discourse, the water cooler, just things you hear every day from people, what would you say are some of the biggest misconceptions, misunderstandings about the program out there just among the populace?
The major thing, of course, is this notion that it's going somewhere, that it's not going to be there for people. When in fact, as long as people are working, the benefits will continue to flow.
Yeah, I feel, I mean, of all the programs, you know, we're all well aware, especially now after the past decade or even maybe 5 years, we're all well aware of how futile it can be to show data to folks who are emotionally invested in a position. So I'm well aware that, like, even if a program works well, that if people don't see it as going to deserving folks or it isn't popular, you can demonize it despite the data. My hope is that, you know, this is such a popular program. It works so well. And like you said, it's, we're in this context now where we're all so fearful of the way the world can change and we can become so insecure so quickly. I am hopeful of all the programs that I think could be killed. This is one that I don't feel like, I feel like we're going to eventually, it may take a crisis.
Yes. I think it will take a crisis.
Yeah. 11:59 PM hour crisis. Yeah. Yes. You know, so Kathleen, so obviously some of these resources are going to be stuff that's at the center on budget and policy priorities and some are not, but what are some great online resources for folks to understand these types of issues, to maybe some calculators, things like that, some places they can go to, I don't know, to explore this issue further?
Well, I would point people first to the Social Security Administration's website. They have something called My Social Security, and you can go, they have calculators that are so much better than the calculators you could get, you know, online at a different source, because you can, they can use your own earnings history, your own circumstances to give you estimates of what your benefit might, your benefit would be, you know, on your current trajectory.
That's awesome.
So that's really awesome and really valuable. And you can even kind of game out different scenarios. So that's a really valuable tool. I would not waste my time with, you know, kind of calculators on random websites when you can go and use your own data. So that's one place I would go. Of course, at the Center on Budget, I think we have some really good stuff. One of our most popular Social Security reports is just called the Social Security top 10 facts about Social Security. And it can lead you through some of these things that I think are often misunderstood about Social Security, and it's really accessible. And so I think that is a one good resource. And then we have something specifically about the trust funds, just because that is something that people often don't understand. So how do the Social Security trust funds work? And I think when people understand that, then they feel a lot more confident about their future.
All right. Well, before we go, if you want to check out the work of the folks at the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities, where Kathleen Romig works, you can go to cbpp.org. We will also link to some of Kathleen's research on our website. We are so lucky to have had you on the show today. You're such a great expert on Social Security and SSI and paid leave. Kathleen Romig, thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thank you for having me.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling until then. Who cares about the clouds when we're together? Just sing a song and bring the sunny weather. Happy trails to you till we meet again. happy trails to you. Until we meet again, happy trails to you. Keep smiling until then. Who cares about the clouds when we're together? Just sing the song and bring the sunny weather. Happy trails to you till we meet again.
Goodbye, good luck, and may the good Lord take a liking to you.